Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. The Washington Post said on Sunday the Obama administration is preparing unprecedented economic sanctions against Chinese companies and individuals who benefit from the cyber theft of valuable U.S. trade secrets. VOA's Victor Beatty reports.
The paper, quoting several administration officials, says the United States has not yet decided to issue the sanctions, which could involve asset freezes and blocking the financial transactions of those engaged in cyber attacks. However, they say a final call is expected perhaps in the next 2 weeks, about the time President Xi arrives on his first state visit to Washington. It says the timing of the sanctions to the visit indicates how frustrated U.S. officials have become over persistent cyber plundering. The paper says while China is not the only country that hacks computer networks for trade secrets, it is by far the most active. China has denied such allegations and insists it is the victim of cyber attacks. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
The U.S. President Barack Obama is traveling Monday to the northwestern state of Alaska to meet with residents and deliver an address at a conference where U.S. and foreign officials, scientists, and locals are gathering to discuss the effects of climate change on the Arctic region. The goal of the Glacier Conference, according to the White House, is to boost awareness of how the effects of higher temperatures in the Arctic are affecting the rest of the world and what people can do in response. The issue was the focus of Mr. Obama's weekly presidential address, during which he said Alaskans are experiencing more frequent and extensive wildfires, deteriorating glaciers, some of the fastest shoreline erosion in the world, and higher storm surges as sea ice melts. This is VOA News. Nigeria's State Security Agency says it has arrested Boko Haram members in the capital Abuja and largest city Lagos, cities usually outside the area of operations for the Islamist extremist group. Chris Stein reports from Lagos.
The Department of State Services says agents arrested 9 suspected Boko Haram members over the last 2 months in Lagos. Last week, they also announced the capture of a boy suspected of spying on the airport in Abuja, along with arrests in the southeastern city of Enugu and the northern cities of Kano and Gombe. National Security spokesman Mike O'Meary says the arrests show Boko Haram is trying to carry out attacks far from its stronghold in the country's northeast.
They may have intention of escalating the fight. After all, the current effort has degraded them and has scattered many of them.
While Boko Haram has repeatedly carried out bombings and shootings in locations across the north, they've only occasionally struck Abuja and its suburbs, and only once succeeded in striking Lagos. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
A 25-year-old Ukrainian security officer was shot to death Monday in Kiev, and dozens of protesters and police were wounded in an explosion during protests against more autonomy for pro-Russian insurgents in eastern Ukraine. Mostly peaceful flag-waving protests outside parliament turned violent after lawmakers voted to give preliminary approval to the changes demanded by the West that are aimed at restoring peace in the rest of East. The interior ministers of Britain, France, and Germany have called for urgent action to address the challenges of thousands of migrants flowing into Europe, which has divided European nations as they debate how to respond. Ministers of Britain, France, and Germany issued a joint statement Sunday asking current European Union President Luxembourg to hold a meeting within 2 weeks. Thai authorities investigating this month's deadly Bangkok bomb attack on Monday announced finding more bomb-making materials in a raid on an apartment in the capital and issued arrest warrants for 2 new suspects, a 26-year-old Thai woman and a foreign man. Photograph of the woman, identified as Wana Suansan in a hijab, and a sketch of the unnamed male suspect were shown on a special broadcast on all Thai television channels. And Malaysia's government staked its claim to the capital's streets Monday after a 2-day demonstration calling for the ouster of Prime Minister Najib Razak. Mr. Najib joined thousands of spectators Monday in Kuala Lumpur for the parade of police, soldiers, and civil servants. The Prime Minister, who is facing serious fraud allegations, has vowed not to step down from office and admonished the protesters for their shallow mind and poor national spirit. I'm Bob Doty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiyesu Uhiben coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
South Sudan's government and rebels have accused each other of breaking the ceasefire that was supposed to go into effect on Saturday.
That's Martha van der Wolf reporting from Addis Ababa. Details coming up.
Also, European leaders have called a meeting in 2 weeks to better manage thousands of refugees and migrants from the Middle East and Africa. And the UN Humanitarian Coordinator for Somalia says more than 850,000 people are facing a food emergency.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Senegal, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, European leaders have called a meeting in 2 weeks to better manage more than 300,000 refugees and migrants from the Middle East and Africa. Interior ministers from Britain, France and Germany say they hope for urgent action on September 14th in Luxembourg. The aim is to resolve disagreements among EU states over controlling refugee flows. Meanwhile, thousands of migrants continue to pour into Europe's frontline states of Italy, Greece, and Hungary. Trainloads of people, mostly from Syria, are leaving Budapest Eastern Railway Station for Austria and Germany. However, Austrian authorities say any migrants not registered in Hungary will be stopped at the border. Meanwhile, deaths on the Mediterranean continue to mount as 37 people drowned when their wooden boat sank off the coast of Libya. More than 2,400 refugees have drowned this year trying to make the crossing from North Africa to Europe. Also, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has called for a special meeting of the General Assembly September 30th to respond to the refugee crisis.
Egypt plans to hold its long-delayed parliamentary elections in October and November this year after more than 3 years without a legislative branch. Analysts say the new parliament may help restore some of Egypt's international credibility, but it may do little to improve the lives of people at home. Heather Murdoch reports.
Chairman of the High Electoral Committee, Chancellor Ayman Abbas, says the elections will begin October 18th and conclude after two-day phases on November 23rd. He warns future parliamentary candidates against inciting violence or attempting to rig the elections. The new legislative body would make the government appear more legitimate to international investors, says political sociologist Syed Sadiq. But he says with more than 100 political parties and many new rules in place, it may be a long time before it makes substantial accomplishments.
It's a huge parliament. This is the biggest in Egyptian history. 597 members. We never had such a big parliament.
Current laws in Egypt are passed by the decree of President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, including new anti-terrorism law 2 weeks ago that has drawn criticism from human rights groups that say it will be used to quiet opponents and the press. Egypt has been without a parliament since June 2012, when a Muslim Brotherhood-dominated parliament dissolved. The upcoming elections were delayed from March for technical and legal reasons. But some analysts say the real reason for the delay was so the government could beat the now-banned Muslim Brotherhood and ensure its supporters don't win seats in the new House. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Cairo.
South Sudan's government and rebels have accused each other of breaking the ceasefire that was supposed to go into effect on Saturday. Marta van der Wolf reports from Addis Ababa.
Fighting in South Sudan continues despite the ceasefire deal stating that all fighting should have stopped Saturday night. At a news conference in Addis Ababa on Monday, former vice president-turned-rebel leader Riek Machar accused government troops of not honoring the peace deal.
Up to this morning, they have been fighting in unity. They have troops that they don't control, who are burning villages, killing civil population, and all that.
But South Sudan Army spokesman Colonel Philip Aguirre says forces loyal to Machar have attacked forces loyal to President Kiir with the intention of gaining more territory. President Kiir signed a peace deal last Wednesday while voicing strong reservations about it. The deal calls for demilitarizing the capital city of Juba, forming a transitional government of unity within 90 days, and giving rebels the position of vice president. Machar says there is a danger the continuous fighting will wreck the peace agreement.
We question the political will of the government. Is the government serious to implement the peace agreement? Is the government united behind the peace agreement? Or do they have divisions?
Several previous agreements between the government and rebels broke down almost as soon as they were signed. The 20-month-long conflict in South Sudan began after the president accused Machar, his former deputy, of plotting a coup. Fighting escalated quickly and ethnic tensions flared as well. More than 2 million civilians have been displaced, with most of them in need of humanitarian aid. The United Nations has threatened to impose travel and financial sanctions against those suspected of obstructing the peace process. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Meanwhile, the South Sudanese cabinet has approved the agreement to end 20 months of conflict. The agreement already had been signed by President Salva Kiir. It now goes to Parliament for final approval. Cabinet ministers made their decision Friday at a meeting chaired by Vice President James Wani Iga. For VOA News, Philip Tonaliu reports from Juba.
Speaking to reporters late Friday, government spokesman Michael Makwe said cabinet ministers unanimously approved the peace deal that Mr. Kiir signed 2 days earlier.
The Council of Ministers applauded the bold and courageous decision taken by His Excellency the President by signing the peace agreement so that people of South Sudan can live in peace and stop all these killings and fighting.
The cabinet decision to approve the peace deal is a U-turn from 2 weeks ago when Riek Machar signed the IGAD brokered deal for the armed opposition and Pagana Mom signed for the group of former political detainees. Then government ministers described the agreement as a sellout and a bad deal for South Sudan. Rallies against the deal were staged across the country, but the tone changed when President Kiir added his signature to the deal last Wednesday. Under the terms of the peace agreement, a new position of first vice president in a transitional government of national unity will be created and occupied by someone from the armed opposition led by former vice president Riek Machar. Current vice president James Wani Iga will be the third in command when the transitional government is formed. By signing the agreement, the government and the armed opposition also agreed to draw down troop numbers and establish demilitarized areas, a monitoring and verification mechanism that was set up during the conflict to report on breaches of earlier ceasefire agreements will be expanded now that peace has been agreed. Both sides have already abided by one of the key provisions of the peace deal and declared a ceasefire. Makwe says the government is committed to fully implementing the deal.
And call upon the people of South Sudan to stand behind the president and support him so that we can move towards the implementation of this agreement, especially at a time when he had also gone further and declared a permanent ceasefire.
When Mr. Kiir signed the deal, he released a long list of reservations that the government has with the agreement. The international community has said it rejects those reservations, and the United Nations Security Council has threatened to impose sanctions and an arms embargo on South Sudan if the conditions and complaints are not dropped by tomorrow. Makwe did not mention the government intends to withdraw its reservations, but he did say that some of the benefits of peace began to be felt immediately after President Kiir signed the agreement last Wednesday.
The price of dollar has dropped, and this started to decline immediately with the signing of the agreement. And as of today, the dollar has dropped to £8. It has now dropped to £8 per dollar, which means that the pound is beginning to move a little bit up, and there is likelihood of this, of the dollar dropping further, and our pound coming up, and We are optimistic that if peace continues like this, then the pound will go back to its original position.
The dollar exchange rate is important to the people of South Sudan because most consumer goods are imported and paid for in the U.S. currency. When the dollar gets stronger, as it has in the past year, the price of goods in South Sudan goes up. When it gets weaker, they go down. People of South Sudan have had a hard time affording basic goods as prices have skyrocketed during the conflict, partly because of the weak South Sudanese pound. But a large benefit is that there has been no major clashes reported between government and opposition forces since the ceasefire took effect at midnight on Saturday. For VOA News, I am Philip Tonaleu in Juba.
The UN Humanitarian Coordinator for Somalia says over the last 6 months, there has been a 17% increase in the number of Somalis experiencing a food crisis. Peter de Klerk says more than 850,000 people are facing a food emergency, up from 731,000. Overall, in Somalia, more than 3 million people need humanitarian assistance. Some 200,000 children are reported malnourished. Part of the problem is blamed on an early end to seasonal rains, which led to a drop in food production. However, conditions could get worse. Very heavy rains may be in store for Somalia as early as September due to the El Nino weather phenomenon. Humanitarian officials fear flooding along the Juba and Shabelle rivers could destroy crops and livestock. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehisu Heap, 17 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. European leaders have called a meeting in 2 weeks to better manage thousands of refugees and migrants from the Middle East and Africa. South Sudan's government and rebels have accused each other of breaking the ceasefire that was supposed to be in effect on Saturday. And the UN Humanitarian Coordinator for Somalia says more than 850,000 people are facing a food emergency. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
The governor of Nigeria's Borno State says 56 residents of the remote village of Banu were killed on Saturday by Boko Haram extremists. Kashim Setima made the announcement in Maiduguri. He met with the parents of more than 200 girls kidnapped more than 500 days ago in Chibok. He described Boko Haram as a calamity. Authorities still do not know what happened to the schoolgirls. Boko Haram has waged a six-year insurgency that has displaced more than 1.5 million Nigerians and led to the deaths of thousands of others.
Nigeria's state security agency says it has arrested Boko Haram members in the capital Abuja and in the largest city, Lagos, cities usually outside the area of operations for the Islamist extremist group. Christine reports from Lagos.
The Department of State Services says agents arrested 9 suspected Boko Haram members over the last 2 months in Lagos. Last week, they also announced the capture of a boy suspected of spying on the airport in Abuja, along with arrests in the southeastern city of Enugu and the northern cities of Kano and Gombe. National Security spokesman Mike O'Meary says the arrests show Boko Haram is trying to carry out attacks far from its stronghold in the country's northeast.
They may have intention of escalating the fight. After all, the current effort has degraded them and has scattered many of them.
While Boko Haram has repeatedly carried out bombings and shootings in locations across the north, they've only occasionally struck Abuja and its suburbs, and only once succeeded in striking Lagos. Ryan Cummings, chief Africa analyst at the risk consultancy firm Red 24, says the arrests show Boko Haram wants to hit Nigeria where it hurts the most.
Both cities, from an operational and strategic perspective for Boko Haram, would make sense to be targeted because it would be hitting at Nigeria's political and respective economic heartland.
Cummings questioned whether those arrested were indeed from Boko Haram. He says that in the past, Nigeria's security forces have failed to develop intelligence networks that can gather information on the group.
They've been poor in firstly gathering actionable intelligence on the group and then responding to that intelligence.
Omeri said the arrests were made after thorough investigations. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
There's both good news and bad news about life expectancy. The good news is people are living longer. The bad news is there's a bigger risk for poor health. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Around the world, life expectancy has risen by 6 years since 1990. A new study says much of that is due to advances against HIV/AIDS and malaria. In addition, progress has been made in reducing deaths from communicable diseases and maternal, newborn, and nutritional disorders. The top 10 places with the highest life expectancies are Japan, Singapore, Andorra, which is a microstate near Spain and France, Iceland, and Cyprus, followed by Israel, France, Italy, South Korea, and Canada. The U.S. ranks 34th in the World Health Organization's rankings for life expectancy. That's believed due to a wide range of health issues among a diverse population. Teo Voss is the lead author of the study. He's a professor of global health at the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington. Voss says there's been a marked reduction in mortality rates from almost all causes.
Most importantly, all the infectious diseases that affect young children, the neonatal problems, so the problems following birth. But we've also seen very steady declines in injury deaths, and the rates of mortality from some of the big non-communicable diseases are slowly, or a bit more than slowly, declining as well.
For many, however, the quality of life in those extra years may be marred by health problems.
You increase the average lifespan of people, and with increasing age, you are more likely to get diseases that impair your ability to function. While we've been relatively successful at reducing the big causes of death, we've been less successful in making a dent in these causes of long-term disabilities.
Voss says some diseases and disabilities can be prevented, but he says investment in treating or curing them has not kept pace with investments for major diseases.
So we make a plea to medical research community to start thinking about investing more in those big causes of disability rather than mortality. And hopefully that will lead to some of the breakthroughs that we've seen that have led to the reduction in mortality.
9 out of the 10 countries with the lowest life expectancies are in sub-Saharan Africa. Lesotho is the worst, with a life expectancy of just 42 years. It's followed by Swaziland, Central African Republic, Guinea-Bissau, and Zimbabwe. Then Mozambique, Afghanistan, Chad, South Sudan, and Zambia.
Yeah, the big common threat there is the extent of the HIV epidemic. I actually worked for 10 years in Southern Africa myself, and I worked in Lesotho before HIV had affected the country. There were already a lot of poverty-related diseases.
Ischemic heart disease, a reduced blood flow to the heart, is the leading cause of what's officially known as DALY, or disability-adjusted life years. Number two is lower respiratory infection, followed by stroke, low back and neck pain, and road injuries. Then there are diarrheal diseases. Chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, also known as COPD, which includes chronic bronchitis and emphysema. there are also neonatal preterm birth complications and HIV/AIDS. And adding to the list, vision and hearing loss and mental health disorders. The findings are based on an analysis of all major diseases and injuries in 188 countries. Professor Voss says the goal is to find opportunities to improve health. He says the research will help shape the new Sustainable Development Goals that replace the Millennium Development Goals this year. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. President Barack Obama is in the northwestern state of Alaska to address a conference of U.S. and foreign officials, scientists, and local residents on the effects of climate change on the Arctic region. The White House says the Glacier Conference should boost awareness of how higher temperatures in the Arctic are affecting the rest of the world and what people can do in response. In his weekly presidential address, Mr. Obama said Alaskans are experiencing more frequent and extensive wildfires, deteriorating glaciers, some of the fastest shoreline erosions in the world, and higher storm surges as sea ice melts. The U.S. State Department is hosting today's conference and said that while it has no direct relations to UN talks later this year to create a binding plan for addressing climate change, the talks will help drive political will for ambitious action. Sessions will include science cooperation, renewable energy, strengthening emergency responses, and preventing unregulated fishing in Arctic seas. This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. It's 27 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Let's talk. Wife earning more money than her husband. Join host Sunday Shomari and his guests discussing this sensitive issue. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. This is James Bratty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. European leaders call a meeting in 2 weeks to better manage thousands of refugees and migrants from the Middle East and Africa. South Sudan's government and rebels accuse each other of breaking the ceasefire that was supposed to go into effect on Saturday. And the UN humanitarian coordinator for Somalia says more than 850,000 people are facing a food emergency. Coming up, we'll have music from Senegal. And in our feature segment, we'll find out about an invention to convert household trash into cleaner cooking fuel for poor families. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And, of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Monday, Sunny.
Happy Monday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you have kudos for Kenya Athletics today.
Kim, here's a Sunny Side of Sports salute to Kenya, which has become the first African country to top the medals table at the World Athletics Championships. The Kenyans made history at the 15th edition of the championships in Beijing, China, as we hear now from the VOA's Nightline Africa sportsman, Shagun Dot, on the spot at Ayemi.
Good evening, Africa. Kenya has made history by becoming the first African nation to emerge the overall winner of the two yearly World Athletics Championships. The East African nation finished on top of the medals table at the 15th edition of the championships. Kenya won a total of 7 golds, 6 silver and 3 bronze medals to finish ahead of Jamaica with 7 gold, 2 silver and 3 bronze medals, and the United States with 6 each of gold, silver and bronze. Until this year's edition, Kenya's best outing was a second place overall finish at the 2007 edition of the championships in Osaka, Japan. In the first edition of the championships in Helsinki, Finland in 1983, Kenya did not even appear on the medals table. Altogether, 8 African teams made it to the medals table at the just concluded 2015 edition. They are, in the order in which they finished, Kenya, Ethiopia, South Africa, Eritrea, Egypt, Tunisia, Morocco, and Uganda. Congratulations to Kenya, the overall winner of the 2015 World Athletics Championships, for this great achievement. In one of the highlights Sunday, the final day, African runners made it a 1-2 finish in the women's marathon. Mary Dibaba of Ethiopia won the gold in 2 hours, 27 minutes and 35 seconds. She was followed by Hella Kiprop of Kenya in 2 hours, 27 minutes and 36 seconds. Staying with the World Athletics Championships, perhaps one of the biggest flops at the event is Nigeria's captain and Africa's fastest woman, Blessing Okagbari. She failed to win any medal in her 3 events in Beijing. In this telephone conversation, I asked the spokesman for Team Nigeria, Olukayode Thomas, what happened to Blessing Okagbari.
I think basically what happened to Blessing is just anything that can happen in sports. She did well up to the semifinals. She had the joint second fastest time. In the final, unfortunately, she didn't get a medal. But if you look at it in the last 3 or 4 years, she's been consistent, getting to the final and winning medals. So sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. It's painful for her. She's down, and everybody's trying to cheer up that, look, it's not the end of the world. There is Euro next year. Just get ready, prepare, and go for it the next time.
Nigeria won 1 silver and 1 bronze at the 2013 edition of the championships in Moscow. In the just concluded 2015 edition, the country did not win a single medal. Should we read any meaning to this in terms of the growth of the sport in Nigeria?
Truth of the matter is that in the last 20 years, we have not done anything in terms of sport development in Nigeria. All we have been doing is sport promotion. We want to go for major championships, we want to go for this. But the thing is, unlike in some other countries, the federal government don't see sport as a priority thing. And secondly, the corporate bodies in Nigeria, they only want to invest in finished products. But what we need to do, the basic, that is development at the grassroots level, intercollegiate and high school sports, is we've neglected them and is dead. And if you don't go back to what Akiye did in the 70s, that made us continental and global champions in the 90s will still remain where we are.
Finally, Kenya has become the first African nation to emerge the overall winner of the World Athletics Championships. Do you have any comment on this?
I think Kenya has just won for Kenya, and Nigeria needs to do what Kenya has done to win for Nigeria. Let's look at what Kenya is doing. Let's look at what Uganda is doing and other small African countries. While they are winning medal in major championship, how Eritrea can produce the marathon winner, a 16-year-old boy that became the marathon champion? What did they do? Let's go back and look at what they have done and adopt those models.
I've been speaking with Olukayode Thomas, the spokesman for Team Nigeria, at the just concluded 2015 World Athletics Championships in Beijing, China. Away from athletics, the stage is set for the resumption of the qualifiers for the 2017 Africa Cup of Nations. Day two matches will be played across the 13 groups next weekend, the weekend of September 4 to 6, that is. The first set of qualifiers were played between June 12th and 14th, 2015. Altogether, six matches will be played by each of the teams seeking to qualify for the tournament finals to be hosted by Gabon. Talking about the African Nations Cup qualifiers, the participating teams have started naming their teams for next weekend's matches, in addition to finalizing their preparations. African champion Ivory Coast has surprisingly left captain Yaya Toure out of its team that will take on Sierra Leone in Nigeria's commercial city of Lagos. Elephants coach Michel Dussier did not include the 32-year-old Yaya Toure in his 23-man squad for the group I Clash, as the players ponders over his international future. Among the invited players are Thomas Toure, Mamadou Bagayoko, Adama Traore, and the local duo of Serge Nguessan and Jimo Sherif. Meanwhile, England-based forward Wilfried Bony has pulled out of the squad after sustaining an injury at training with English Premiership club Manchester City. For its part, 2015 Nations Cup runner-up Ghana has also named the 24-member squad for its Group C match against Rwanda. The coach Avram Grant-led Black Stars will play a friendly against Congo in Brazzaville on Tuesday before traveling to Kigali for the qualifier. Former under-20 stars Godfred Donsa and Ebenezer Sifua were handed call-ups. Andrew Ayew, who missed out of the first group match against Mauritius in Ghana due to injury, has also been named in the squad. Captain Asamoah Gyan will lead the team for the game. Ahead of the qualifier in Kigali, Ghana's opponent, Rwanda, beat Ethiopia 3-1 in a friendly game on Friday at the Amahoro Stadium in Kigali. In the game, Rwanda dominated and opened the score in the 18th minute. However, the Ethiopians never got deflated, and they started to push for the equalizer, which they got in the 41st minute. Rwanda scored two more goals in the second half to complete the tally. In a related development, Gambian coach Raoul Savoy has handed a maiden call-up to China-based forward Boubacar Traoré for the Group M qualifier against Cameroon on September 6th in Banjul, the Gambian capital. The 20-year-old prolific goalscorer was a surprise inclusion in the team's 24-man squad for the Day 2 clash with the four-time African champion. And Uganda coach Milutin Stredojevic has labeled his team's Group D qualifier against Comoros next Saturday the most important match of the campaign. The Cranes of Uganda beat Botswana 2-0 last June and share top spot with Burkina Faso, which beat Comoros by a similar scoreline also on the opening day. The Ugandans will be seeking to return with the maximum points from their trip to Comoros. Another team that has named the squad is Egypt, the most successful team in the history of the Africa Cup of Nations with 7 titles. Coach Hector Cooper of Egypt, which is in the same Group G with the Super Eagles of Nigeria, unveiled a 27-man solid team against Chad in N'Djamena. The Pharaohs kicked off their campaign for a place in Gabon 2017 with a thrilling defeat of Tanzania in Alexandria, while Chad bowed 2-0 to Nigeria in the northern city of Kaduna. Zamalek boasts of 10 players in the squad, while Alali has 8, with 7 foreign-based professionals making the cut. Still in Group G, coach Charles Nkwasa of Tanzania said he's expecting a tough match against the Super Eagles of Nigeria. But he insists that the Taifa Stars can spring a surprise against Sunday Oliseh's men. The Taifa Stars are rooted to the bottom of Group G, having lost 3-0 to Egypt in their first game of the qualifying series. Coach Mukwasa told Nigeria's Brilla FM, a VOA affiliate, that his team is preparing well for the game against Nigeria, even while acknowledging the Super Eagles as one of the strongest teams in Africa. Thanks so much for listening. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
This is Larry Zamude, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 88.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja, Nigeria. Let's talk to you about Brilla FM. It's Nigeria's only sports station. Of course, we partner the VOA. VOA! And so you can listen to Sunny Side of Sports on 88.9 Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja. Keep listening, Africa, and enjoy Sunny Side of Sports on Brilla.
Thanks, Dr. Larry. In addition to sports radio, 88.9 Brilla FM stations in Lagos and Abuja, Dr. Larry also has stations in Kaduna and Onitsha, Nigeria. We're delighted to be your partner, Dr. Larry, so keep it sporty.
The Voice of America, VOA.
Kenya's seventh and final gold medal in Beijing was won by Asbel Kiprop, who came from behind to win his third consecutive world title in the men's 1500 meters final.
I knew that when it comes to the last 200, 250 meters, remember that's how McLaughlin won Olympics in London, here in the last 250. I've been looking at his qualifying rounds when he races my colleague here. They have been running both of them the last 250 meters. But when you compare his last 50 meters, it's not moving. So I was a little bit confident that maybe that's where I could catch them.
That's Asbel Kiprop of Kenya, the three-time world champion in the men's 1500 meters race. And Kiprop was speaking in Beijing, China. Kenya's six other gold medal winners in Beijing were Julius Yego in the men's javelin, David Rudisha in the men's 800 meters race, Nicholas Bett in the men's 400 meters hurdles race, Ezekiel Kemboy in the men's 3,000 meters steeplechase race, Hyvin Jepkemoy in the women's 3,000 meters steeplechase race, and Vivian Chariot in the women's 10,000 meters final. Truly a great showing by the Kenyans at the World Athletics Championships. A history-making performance, and one that's deserving of yet another Sunny Side of Sports salute. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, Rwanda-born Jean Bosco Nziamana's invention to convert household trash into a cleaner cooking fuel for poor families. And next, one initiative on the outskirts of Nairobi that's converting human waste into electricity. But first, some music. Here is Viviane Ndour of Senegal with Samanene. Yeah. Vivian Endor of Senegal with Samanene.
Well, Rwanda-born Jean Bosco Nzeyimana has won awards for his inventions. One of his devices composts household trash into cleaner cooking fuel for poor families. He was in Washington, D.C. recently as a Mandela Washington Fellow and one of hundreds of Africa's best young thinkers and actors. VOA's Paul Ndiho has more.
21-year-old Jean Bosco Nzeyimana is the founder and CEO of Habona Limited, a Rwandan startup trying to address the lack of electricity in his rural village of Kitabi. He is part of a new breed of young African innovators trying to change Rwanda's image.
I have a company back home called the Habona Limited. It does a lot of work regarding waste management, whereby we collect waste, and after collecting the waste, we use them to produce affordable and environmentally friendly products in the form of biomass briquettes.
Jean Bosco's fascination with biogas started when he was a young boy, and his vision to create a biogas plant that can transform organic waste into flammable gas that can be distributed to the local population for their energy needs. He's partnering with the government to collect household trash, which he then sells as cleaner, cheaper source of cooking fuel for poor families in Rwanda.
I grew up just thinking about what I can do for my family. So I came up with the idea of taking advantage of waste and use them to produce these kind of fuels, which are actually better for the lives of people.
In his village, he's just a regular guy. In fact, very few people know about his innovation that is generating a buzz on the international scene. Jean Bosco was crowned last year as the winner of the Africa Innovation Prize and also recognized in 2014 as a top young entrepreneur in Rwanda.
Being recognized as the top young entrepreneur of Rwanda was very, very good for me because, you know, it showed me that I'm doing meaningful things. It showed me that, you know, what I do is really impactful to the community, and it gave me some sense of, like, motivation.
For a rising biogas, a firm like Habona Limited, partnering with the right people in the business can definitely go a long way, as he plans to construct a biogas plant in his native country. While here in the United States, Jean Bosco attended Northwestern University for 6 weeks as part of the yearly fellowship. Dr. Mavi Norman served as a peer collaborator for Jean Bosco.
Bosco is an amazing, amazing young gentleman. Since I met him about 6 weeks ago, he's just shown to be a very serious, very focused, very diligent, very charismatic young man, and I'm certain that he is going to make some serious strides in Rwanda, but even beyond, throughout Africa.
Despite his early success, the young entrepreneur is focused on perfecting his innovation. He attributes his accomplishment to hard work.
Yeah. What does success mean to you?
When people look at me, they say this young man is successful, and they say, you know, he has won a lot of prizes, he has done this, but that doesn't mean success to me. For me, success is what I do to promote my society. Success means what I'm doing, how I'm working hard at my company.
The full implementation of this project will enable his company, Habona, to distribute biogas and biofertilizer to more than 500,000 households. For a young man whose dreams are big, the sky is the limit. Paul Ndiho, VOA News.
Two years ago, President Barack Obama launched the multi-year Power Africa initiative to serve tens of millions of Africans with little or no access to power. Lenny Ruvaga reports on one initiative on the outskirts of Nairobi that's converting human waste into electricity.
This is Mukuru Kwanjengo, a slum of about 100,000 people on the outskirts of Nairobi. Most of its residents do not have electricity. Those who do are illegally connected. Amos Nguru is the brains behind an innovation that generates electricity from human waste. 2 years ago, Nguru received a Power Africa grant funded by General Electric and the United States African Development Foundation. The gas generator produces 15 kilowatts of electricity, enough to power the nearby school and serve the local community. Nguru says the project helps meet the needs of the community.
Mukuru Kwajenga has power challenges, going by the fact that they have a lot of illegal connections, so power keeps on going on and off. And then they also have a sanitation problem.
The Mukuru Kwajenga Primary School, with about 2,000 students, now gets its electricity from Nguru's project after disconnecting from the old power source. School administrator Deborah Mwandangina says there were too many illegal connections to the school's power supply, which incurred bills the school was unable to foot.
We've been having challenges with the slums, and time and again they hack our power systems and they disconnect illegally to their homes, and we've been having such challenges. So we just decided we cannot live without electricity. It can't do us any good. So we decided to disconnect.
Student Doreen Kemunto, who lives in the slum, is glad her school has access to clean energy. Her mother says darkness no longer limits Doreen's studies.
Before the electricity was there, our children were not to be able to learn since they could not come to school that early and leave at least because the school was very dark and they could not be able to learn.
According to the World Bank, only 23% of Kenya's population has access to electricity. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Despite an agreement by militant groups there to disarm, sporadic violence continues in the Central African Republic. In the most recent incident, some 42 people traveling by truck in central CAR were killed in an ambush August 24th. Gunmen forced the vehicle to stop by shooting its tires, then its passengers, as it entered a village northeast of the capital, Bangui. The United States is committed to working with others in the international community to prevent further destabilization in CAR and to bring peace and security to its people. To that end, the U.S. Treasury Department has imposed sanctions against three men leading groups threatening the peace, security, and stability there. Action was also taken against a diamond company and its Belgian affiliate that are helping fuel the violence through an illicit trade in CAR's natural resources. Any assets these individuals and entities may have under U.S. jurisdiction are now frozen, and Americans are generally prohibited from doing business with them. Sanctioned were Alfred Yekatum, commander of anti-Balaka forces in and around Bangui, suspected of conducting an ethnic cleansing campaign against Muslims. Habib Susu, an anti-Balaka commander who has repeatedly threatened Muslims and organizations distributing food aid to them. And Umar Yunus, a senior Seleka commander involved in an illicit diamond trade. Badika, one of the largest diamond companies in the CAR, and Cardiam, Badika's branch in Antwerp, Belgium, were sanctioned for making illicit payments to Seleka leaders to obtain diamonds from mines under the group's control and smuggle them out of the country. The sanctions, which are in line with sanctions measures taken at the United Nations Security Council, follow several steps our nation is taking to address the critical needs in the CAR. The United States strongly supports the transitional government and the efforts of the people of CAR to find lasting peace and security. Over the past 2 years, we have committed more than $800 million in humanitarian aid, peacekeeping support, and investments in reconciliation and rule of law. Ultimately, however, the people of CAR hold their future in their own hands. We continue to urge all parties to end the violence, prepare and participate in the elections process, refrain from supporting spoilers whose motives are counter to long-term stability and peace, and move ahead toward a better future for their nation and people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Next on Let's Talk, wife earning more money than her husband. Join host Sunday Shomari and his guests discussing this sensitive issue. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.